For the light.
Okay.
We're on now? Okay. So, welcome everyone to the March 17th, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. Senator Boquist, we will open on Senate Bill 770, public hearing to allow you to speak and get back to your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Edwards, Senator Burdick, small committee today. That's how I start out, too. And I have a president in my room. See, in my military affairs committee, Mr. Chairman, you know, he calls me the general. And I say, yeah, but we have civilian rule, and you're the president. So you just tell me what I'm going to do next. So it works out quite well. Colleagues, yeah, before you, I'll be try to be as brief as possible and give you a little bit of history of 770, where it came from. In the last session, on behalf of union members in my district, don't fall off your chairs, okay? I introduced SB 872, and I initially felt like, you know, somebody going into the Lions Den, because I actually went out and met with all, you know, went to the union meeting and everything else like that, and I'm still here. It was actually a very good event and learned a lot of things. And the issue that was coming up is in the private sector and a lot of the contracts, we see a lot of out-of-state competition. We had a hearing in our Small Business Consumer Committee just a couple of weeks ago, and it was interesting to see how some of the public entities define in-state contractors, and they define in-state contractors as anybody who has an address in Oregon. And unfortunately, they weren't very pleased when I said, well, in order to do any business, you have to have a registered agent. So just because you have a street address for a registered agent doesn't make you an Oregon State company. But anyway, having said that, one of the issues that came up last session and continues to come up, you know, even at this point, is that there is sometimes in government contracting an unequal bias in contracting. What you have before you is Senate Bill 770, and it really has two components to it. The first component to it allows a resident bidder, when they submitted a proposal to the state for a contract, to be given a preference in bidding if their state of origin has that same preference. For your information, that's actually called market participation exceptions under the Constitution, which makes it, it complies with the Commerce Clause. And the reason being, we started down that line, is the second portion of this contract that is a little interesting thing, which I think it'll, if you did something to move this bill, would actually probably go to another committee, the Senator Burdick's committee, and that's because the second portion of the bill, you look down, it says that they can get a preference for this, and you calculate what the in-state taxation benefit is of the contract. And so what we're really talking about is if you have an Oregon-based company, the rate of return to the state comes in significantly different than an out-of-state. For example, if you have a million-dollar contract, it's executed inside the state of Oregon. Those Oregon employees pay Oregon taxes. Those Oregon companies pay Oregon taxes, and those are calculatable according to the Legislative Revenue Office. And so if you take that into calculation in the amount of revenue that's going to return to the state from the Oregon bidder, successful bidder, versus the out-of-state successful bidder, is in fact a lower cost to the state of Oregon for that contract. So as you can see, it gets real complex real quick, Mr. Chair, as you kind of go through this process, even though it looks like it's a simple bill. Having said that, I know at a later point there's some other testimony that's going to come forward. And again, what we're trying to do is level the playing field, put our workers back to work. And again, this does not compete with the Commerce Clause. The way it's been written by legislative counsel, it applies to states that already have, and I believe there are 38 states that have preferences that prefer to have their contractors do work over our contractors. And so we're simply trying to level the playing field and then identify what is the best benefit for the state of Oregon. With that, I will be quiet, answer any questions, and let you go on with your regular business, and then other members will bring this to you later.
Thank you. So I'm just curious, you said you measure the taxes that would be paid by the workers?
Would be paid by the Oregon company, exactly.
By the company, not by the workers?
Well, you can measure it by the company, the workers, so on and so forth, and you can take that into account.
So you'd have to identify which ones were Oregon residents, for example, and which ones were Washington residents?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but I think we might even start. I'm looking at a piece of paper that was submitted to another committee this session, and it identified 10 companies as Oregon companies. They're also the 10 largest contractors to a particular public agency in the state of Oregon, and in fact, only two of them are Oregon companies because they have a registered agent here. So it is a little bit complex, and it would be beyond the responsibility of the bidding company to present that packet forthright to the public entity. So it is an interesting concept.
It is. Any questions of the senator? I guess there are none. Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Burdick, Senator Edwards, and I see my people are missing, right?
Thank you. We're going to recess on Senate Bill 770 and move back to our regular agenda, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 764. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 764 authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to adopt rules declaring an alcohol impact area upon petition by a representative of a municipality having a population of 50,000 persons or more. It authorizes the OLCC to take actions to reduce the serious and persistent problems within an alcohol impact area. There is no revenue impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal on this.
Alrighty, so since this is a City of Eugene bill, let's let the City of Eugene contingent go first. Councilor Clark, you want to bring up whoever you want to bring up with you?
Good afternoon. Chair Byer, Senators, my name is Mike Clark, and I'm a Eugene City Councilor. I'm here today speaking on behalf of our mayor and our council. I'm also a proud resident of Senate District 7. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today for 764. The City of Eugene, along with many Oregon's larger cities, facing the consistent and ongoing public safety issue of alcohol-related crime incidents. This bill is designed to help us join in with a program that already exists for the City of Portland alone and gives a couple of other cities the opportunity to petition for the right with OLCC to participate. It's one that gives us a very strategic law enforcement tool. As a couple of you know, our Lane County Jail has about 20% of the capacity that any law enforcement professional would tell you a good county jail should have. And subsequently, we're in a place where we're having to get a little bit more creative with crime prevention techniques. This is one that we'd like to have in our toolbox. The incidents of alcohol-related crime represent a significant drain on police resources that are already stretched thin. These incidents also negatively affect neighborhood safety and livability. As you know, dealing with alcohol-related crimes and incidents of public intoxication take extraordinary resources. This is a step that we believe can be both proactive and preventative. Alcohol impact areas are a tool that cities can use to help reduce the drain on city and public safety resources. The state of Washington has several successful AIAs which have been found to reduce alcohol-related crime incidents as well as public health and safety issues. In Eugene, as Sergeant Fitzpatrick will tell you about, I'm sure, here just shortly, we had a voluntary program for a very short period of time over the course of this last year where we had two stores in downtown Eugene, or I believe three.
Total of seven.
I was aware of the two. I'm sorry. For a total of seven who voluntarily agreed for a specific period of time to stop selling fortified malt beverages and wines and such. And we saw significant decrease in the amount of nuisance crime that we experienced in our downtown core. And as I said, I'm sure the sergeant will be more specific about that. Senate Bill 764 would allow Oregon's larger cities to petition the OLCC and make a case for the establishment of an alcohol impact area that would be specifically tailored to the environment that we hope to have an impact on. Having the ability to establish an alcohol impact area could result in fewer calls for police services for alcohol-related crimes and incidents, which would mean more time for our police to attempt other issues to attend to other issues result in city and public safety resource savings. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions after any of my colleagues would have their testimony as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Terry Fitzpatrick. I'm a sergeant with Eugene Police Department. Been with the police department for approximately 23 years. Recently, down in the Whitaker and the downtown neighborhoods in Eugene, we experienced a dramatic increase in crime, and as a result, we had a lot of the citizens coming to us, coming to council, coming to the mayor, pleading for something to be done. In Eugene, we have a really unique situation in that many traditional law enforcement measures and opportunities are not available to us because we have one of the lowest staffing ratios per population in the nation. So whereas a lot of people tend to try to take the simplistic view and say, well, just if they commit a crime, lock them up. If there's a problem, put more patrols in those areas. We just don't have those opportunities. So what we did is we kind of thought about things that at the time we thought we were really, really smart until we found out a lot of other cities around the nation have done the same thing. We asked a group of businesses in the Whitaker and the downtown area to try a program. All we asked them to do is for the 90-day period, we asked them if they would stop selling the fortified malt beverages. And these are the beverages that are traditionally, some of them have alcohol contents as high as 12%, and many times you can buy these things for 99 cents. And to just put it in perspective, if you look at a 24-ounce can of that, that is the equivalent of getting 8 shots of rum in a 24-ounce can for 99 cents. And this is the type of alcohol that's favored by the chronic inebriants. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah.
Well, if you figure it out at 12% for 3 shots, it's the volume. It's 24 ounces in these big giant cans.
Senator Burt, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did, because that's about the same percentage as wine.
Yeah.
And so,
well, this is a little bit higher than a lot of the wines. A lot of the wine, I'm not a wine drinker, but most of them that I have seen are 14-15%. This is the equivalent of it's the combination of the large volume and the really inexpensive price. Most wine doesn't go for 99 cents a bottle. So what we did is these stores were agreed to do this, and we did a study afterwards, and the results were dramatic, even more dramatic than anything I'd hoped for. The year before, in 2009, in that target area that we did, we had 187 criminal acts. And during the ban period, 1 year later, the only thing we can find different is the voluntary, and I don't want to say ban because that makes it sound like we forced them. This was a voluntary act by the part of the retailers to help us and be good community members. We went from 187 criminal acts down to 56. That was almost a 70% decrease in reported crime in those areas. And even more drastic is we went from 55 alcohol violations down to 7 during the alcohol ban. And more importantly, we got nothing but praise from not only the community members, people that live in the neighborhood, thanking us or saying, finally, it's helping us. One of the Midtown business owners, the association, commented to us that finally they have hope things are going to get better in their area. And as a result, we've also asked the stores to continue with the ban. Some of the stores have agreed to do it. Some of them haven't. In many other communities, the alcohol impact areas have been proven to be very effective. And there's a lot of positive effects that beyond law enforcement that many people don't consider sometimes. The studies that have been done show medical calls in these areas where alcohol impact areas have occurred go down dramatically. Numbers of detoxes go down dramatically. And we actually had one person who was one of our chronic inebriants in town. It gave us the opportunity where finally he couldn't get his alcohol of choice. He had a very specific brand that he wanted to drink. We finally got him into treatment. And that's the ultimate goal, is to try to help everybody.
Did you find any migration of the problem to adjoining neighborhoods or other cities?
We looked at that, and we studied that, and we could find no evidence of what I kind of call squeeze out, out into the neighboring areas. We didn't see any evidence of that. We did studies to look and see if crime in the neighboring areas increased.
And you're referencing studies in other areas. Are there other states that have done this, and is there information on that?
I'm specifically referring to up in Washington, where Seattle and Tacoma both have had alcohol impact areas for many years, and they have studied the problem, and the results and the findings were studied by Washington State University.
Questions in the panel?
You've got a 50,000 population mm-hmm. threshold. I should know this, but isn't this already available for larger cities like Portland?
It is. It's actually available only for cities over 300,000 at this moment,
okay.
So it's only for Portland. The inclusion down to 50 adds 9 cities
okay.
that would then have the capacity to petition the OLCC.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So basically
please.
What you're looking for is the same program that
we
Portland
just like
has.
To join,
you just
please.
Want to have it available for your city. That makes yeah. it easier for me to understand. Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Gerard. Yeah, I think there are bills in the session this time that deal with caffeinated or fortified wines. We're actually trying to ban those statewide, and it seems like that would pretty much take care of your problem, would it not?
I believe you're referring to the FDA ban on caffeinated and alcoholic beverages being mixed. Most of those have already been banned, and as a result of the FDA. And what I've experienced is what's happened is the manufacturers are simply removing the caffeine from their beverages. They're still continuing to sell the high alcohol malt beverages. They're just removing the caffeine.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
Chair Bauer, members of the committee, Adam Walsh, I'm with the City of Eugene. I'd just like to follow up on a few points and from some of the questions from members of the committee. Senator Burdick, you asked about lowering the threshold to 50,000, and you know this would allow us to do the same thing that Portland has done. The rulemaking process that we would undergo, filing the petition, the requirements for information, the public hearings, and outreach to business that you have to undergo during that rulemaking process would be the same. But the parameters for any alcohol impact area are going to be different for every alcohol impact area and in every city. And mm-hmm. for instance, if a city were to have more than one alcohol impact area, hypothetically, the parameters inside each of those, you know, may well be different. They may be the same, but the idea is to be focusing on a geographic area where there is a problem and focusing on the root cause of that problem. So it may not be the same everywhere. Also, in relation to the state of Washington and the alcohol impact areas there, they have been successful in being specific with the products that they would prohibit from sale. There is a constitutional question here in Oregon that the Attorney General is reviewing as to whether or not our Constitution would allow us to be product specific, or in the case of Portland, where you have to write the rule a bit more broadly to be encompassing what you're trying to get at. So there's still a question there. What we can't do, though, now, because we don't meet that threshold, is even be part of the discussion. And what we're not asking for is for an alcohol impact area to be granted, but simply to be able to participate in that process, to work with all of the players involved, because there are concerns legitimately from other folks. But we want an extra tool, and we want an extra tool that works. And being able to be a part of that process is the way to get there. And we appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Senator Tron?
Maybe it's the fact I'm from Oregon State, but
come on.
I have to tell you, I find it kind of ironic because, I mean, if you walk the streets at night in Eugene, Marijuana is pretty rampant, and marijuana is illegal. Alcohol is legal, so I'm having a hard time understanding, why we're going after alcohol when I think there's a lot of illegal and illicit drugs that are out there on the streets.
Absolutely, I agree with you. One of the things that I look at as a patrol officer and understand, I'm the guy that's out on the street every day. I'm responding to the calls. I'm seeing the problems that are occurring out on the street. Right now, one of the things I look at is what is the root cause of the crime? What is causing us problems? And overwhelmingly, and I know this is going to upset some people that, what harsher marijuana penalties, but if you look at the damage that is caused and the calls for service that are being generated for the police department for marijuana versus the chronic inebriate on the street, on the streets of Eugene, the chronic inebriate is by far causing us more problems and a greater drain on our resource. And while we're dealing with those behavioral crimes, although not insignificant for the people that are victimized by these, an example is, we had a lady just very recently where a person highly intoxicated comes up into the playground area where her children and others are working, and this person came up and did something rather disgusting. And, of course, this is a very big thing for her. She called us up, wanted some help, and when we contacted this person, he said, go ahead, throw me in jail. I know you're not going to keep me for more than a couple hours. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to deal with those problems and deal with those root causes. I can just estimate, and this is solely an estimate on my part, I bet anywhere from 15 to 20% of our calls for service on many nights deal specifically with those behavioral crimes, those chronic inebriants that really traditional law enforcement methods don't work. We try to get them into detox. They don't want to go to detox. Taking them to jail literally provides them a vacation for a couple hours. So we're trying to find other ways to deal with the problem.
Chair Bart, Senator Girard, if I could just add to that. I own a business in downtown Eugene. And this is a geographically centered sort of problem. One of the issues in downtown Eugene is really, as the sergeant has mentioned, more about the population of folks who take advantage of these products in a specific area at a specific time and create a great call for service that we have very little remedy for. This is really a prevention tool that we're looking for that certainly isn't by any means comprehensive to address all the problems we face down there, but it's one that we know works and can help alleviate a significant problem for us.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was intrigued by your comment about the lack of supply, if you will, actually driving some people into treatment. And I'm just wondering if there are any studies that you know of that have been done on that effect of a...
I'm not aware of any particular studies on that, but I am aware that in the Tacoma and Seattle alcohol impact areas, they did find a significant decrease in the number of emergency detoxes experienced by detox facilities in those areas following the alcohol impact areas.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, fellows, for coming up and testifying on this. I'd like to thank my city councilor, Councilor Clark, for supporting this bill and being here on behalf of the city of Eugene. One of the mentioned neighborhoods is in my district. This is a real problem. I have to admit that I was skeptical that it would have this effect, and then when I saw the evidence, it's very compelling. It's very compelling, and we have resource issues. Not only here at the state level, but we have resource issues at the local level, and the law enforcement funding has continually been a problem in Eugene. And I thank you for bringing this proposed solution forward, and I hope that members of the committee will consider supporting it. So,
Mr. Walsh, you raised the issue of I think. constitutional question in product-specific identification, which I believe may be how they do it in Seattle. Senator Przanski had mentioned to me that that might be a route that he would support going on. One of his concerns was the impact that it may have, unintentional impact on not home brewing, but microbrews and some of the wines. I understand that some of the, not the low-end wines, but some of the high-end wines have higher alcohol content in them as well. You address that anywhere? Have you thought about that?
Do you want to hear me too? I will. Senator Barr, thank you very much for the question. My understanding is that there is some degree, I'm certainly not an expert on this part and these questions, but I know Senator Przanski had some concerns that he voiced to us as well. I know that our staff is working diligently to try and get him the appropriate answers for that, but I also know that the Portland area had some degree of experience with this, my understanding is that it was able to give us some degree of understanding of how to proceed.
Chair Barr, members of the committee, I would follow that by saying we have looked into the issue. The way one of the reference points that we have at this point, besides just the direction from the rulemaking process, is the City of Portland's application. And from their petition for rulemaking, the definitions that they've used, we feel, would not be impacting breweries in, you know, in the city or anything of that nature, and even more so that there's flexibility enough that we should be able to write that rule to make sure that there is not an unintended consequence in that way.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions of the panel? Thank you very much,
thank
gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Councilor Bennett and Steve Berger. Different hat today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Bennett. I'm president of the Salem City Council. I'm here on behalf of the City Council and Mayor in support of Senate Bill 764. I've submitted written testimony, Mr. Chairman. I really believe the folks from Eugene have done a great job of covering this issue. Again, what we're seeking as a city over 50,000 is the opportunity to take a request to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to operate inside of the rulemaking they establish and are currently engaged in with the City of Portland in order to deal with what is a persistent problem in Salem, which is street drinking, which results in substantial public intoxication and other associated problems. We have problems, Mr. Chairman, with as you might imagine, we have problems with public urination, unruly behavior, late night disturbance. I mean, the list goes on and on, even in a great town like Salem. And in my case, a lot of this is occurring in my ward, so I am secondarily concerned. Besides my role on the council as president,
I thought you were going to tell us that legislators are really hard to control, and it only happens when we're in session.
You fortunately have migrated into Ward 2. I'm Ward 1, so I just sort of stand back and watch. But I could bring in the councilor from that ward. Yeah, my ward no longer includes some of those watering holes. But no, it really is has become a substantial problem here, and we would like to use this as an opportunity, this bill as an opportunity to deal with it. You've heard about the Washington State studies. There have been studies in Seattle, again, that show that there is an impact on local resources to the positive as a result of these. We're expending money on police services that we, for this activity that we would like to save for far more important crimes, but these are the ones that are being reported that are causing livability issues in our community, and like Eugene, we'd like to have the opportunity to at least take a look at this in front of the OLCC. So, thank you. And I have Lieutenant Steve Burr with me. Lieutenant Burr is with the Salem Police Department and can answer any questions you have about what it looks like on the street in Salem.
Any comments, Lieutenant?
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, there were a couple of comments I would like to add. The discussion of...
Give your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry, Lieutenant Steve Burr. There was some discussion about whether such a impact area should involve product-specific items or a description of a general type, such as Portland is asked for prohibition of malt liquors sold in single containers over 5.75% by alcohol. One of the things that came out of the Washington studies is both Seattle and Tacoma found that distillers, even though they said that they were cooperating with the alcohol impact area, merely rebranded their products under different names. And so their list of specific products continues to grow, and it seems to be a never-ending target. So that, for them, has been a problem, which is why I feel, as long as it's constitutional, the Portland definition is far better. In addition, in regards to your concerns about microbrews, they are specifically exempted in the Portland application by using the federal tax statute because they fit a different definition. And lastly, I would just like to point out the discussion regarding marijuana versus alcohol. Companion calls that we get are person down, people passed out in people's front yards, certainly panhandling, which has a nexus to street drinking. I've never seen any of those be tied to somebody using marijuana. And those things definitely impact the livability of the city of Salem.
Questions? This panel. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much.
Let's see here. Thomas Irwin, OLCC.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I'm here this afternoon to offer the support of the Commission for Senate Bill 764. The Commissioners actually voted to support this, I believe it was yesterday. And if there are reasons we want to support it, one of the first reasons is because the current rule, alcohol impact area, is just a rule. It's not in statute. So passing this bill would help us place it in statute, giving it a little more strength, if you will, with the ORSs. And additionally, we see the fact that we're only asking to have 9 additional cities covered when we're talking about the population being 50,000, minimum of 50,000. Should probably not be too big of a hardship on the process. One of the things I think the committee should be aware of is the current process is complex and laborious to even get to the point of asking the commission for adopting the AIA rule. There's a lot of homework that needs to be done. A lot of resources are invested by local governments in order, by the city of Portland in this case, because that's the only city that's able to do this at the present time. But they have to show and demonstrate that they've been able to, or at least tried to, get a voluntary compliance from the retail outlets. So there is quite a process for folks to go through and walk through at the current time. So I'm not trying to deter anyone. I'm just trying to make sure everybody has realistic expectations about what might happen in this process. One of the other things that we wanted to talk about, under the current rule, OLCC allows for the creation of an alcohol impact area in order to address either of two distinct types of problems: A, street drinking and public intoxication resulting from off-premises sales, those sales that are out of a grocery store, a package store, or B, noise and other disturbances resulting from on-premises sales, taverns, bars, and restaurants. The bill would allow establishment of an alcohol impact area to address what we call serious and persistent problems involving disturbances, lewd or unlawful activities, or noise. We have some concerns that the types of serious and persistent problems listed in this bill could be read as excluding street drinking and public intoxication as reasons why an AIA could be established to reduce that this risk. We suggest that the words street drinking and public intoxication be added before the words or noise in section 2 of the bill. The incidence of street drinking and public intoxication would still have to be serious and persistent in order to support the AIA request, but obviously this, as you've heard from previous testimony, this is one of the big reasons why local governments would like to have this particular tool in their kit bag. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
And I may have missed it. The checklist says that OLCC is in support of this. Is the commission itself discussed this? And
Chair Byer, that's correct. Yesterday we had commission meeting, and one of the bills we went through was this particular bill, and they did support the bill with the changes that we're asking for.
Okay.
Yes.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pardon me, I should have thought of this sooner. You said that the current alcohol impact area is by rule. Could you do this by rule, expand it by rule as well?
Chair Byer, Senator Burdick, I've been the nods of the heads and the subject matter experts back in the back room said yes, so I believe so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
But again, having it in statute is something we would prefer. Thank you.
Was there follow up on yours. I was under the impression that the authorization to do it was by statute for, and it was specifically limited to by size to Portland.
And Chair Byer, I asked about the current rule, where our authority came from, since it isn't in statute. We just used our general authority for purposes of designing this rule. That answers your question, hopefully.
Okay, so there isn't a specific statute that directs it to the Portland area. You're just using the commissioner's general authority?
Correct, and in the rule, it talks about the 300,000 threshold. That's population limit.
Okay, but you did that by rule. The commission did that
correct.
By rule.
Absolutely.
Those general powers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
No other questions? All right, now, let's see. Hasina Squires, Paul Romaine, and Dan Jarman. Hasina, you're first on the list.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What a refreshing time it is to testify in the Senate, where I don't have to constantly think co-chair, co-vice chair. This will be my first time this session, so thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, Hasina Squires, on behalf of the Wine Institute, we represent 923 wineries in California in opposition to Senate Bill 764. Our association does not believe that creating numerous alcohol impact areas with various product restrictions is the most effective way to create safer and livable communities. Currently, there are not any alcohol impact areas that have been designated in the state of Oregon, and I actually believe that there never have been any alcohol impact areas that have been enacted in the state of Oregon. So if Portland were successful, they would, in fact, be the first AIA in the state. And because of that, and because Portland does have a petition pending with OLCC, and there hasn't been any ability to evaluate the effectiveness of an alcohol impact area, we do not believe that that authority should be expanded at this point, that there should be some examination of alcohol impact areas, and if Portland were to be successful, how they operate, what functionally works, what does not work, before other local governments are granted that authority. Washington State is the only state in the United States that allows for the creation of alcohol impact areas. My client, Katie Jacoy, who you've received her testimony, could not be here today. She is from Washington State. There are six alcohol impact areas that are have been created in Washington State. The difference between Washington State and how the City of Portland has approached this problem with the designation of an AIA is entirely different. In Washington State, their alcohol impact areas require identification of a specific product. So the burden is on the local government to determine that an actual product is causing a problem within their community, have a specific list of products that are causing problems in the community, and then exclude those from the ability to sell those alcohol impact areas. With respect to Washington. There are no wine-only bans within those six AIAs. There are only eight fortified wine products that are banned total. In the City of Portland's petition, 50 products would be affected. We also oppose the bill, and I'm pleased to hear that OLCC would like a couple of changes to the bill. We believe that this bill lowers the standards that are in the current OLCC rule to put forth an AIA petition. The purposes for which you could request an alcohol impact area, we believe, are vague. They don't require a direct tie to alcohol consumption. For example, a city could request an AIA for the purposes of reducing serious and persistent problems in the area involving disturbances, lewd or unlawful activities, or noise. The current OLCC rule includes language that says the petition must propose rule language to reduce street drinking and public intoxication with off-premise sales or noisy conduct and late-night disturbances associated with on-premise consumption. In addition, we believe that the bill creates a very weak threshold for proposing an AIA. The problems not necessarily related to alcohol consumption cannot be readily attributed to a particular licensed premises. The OLCC rule that currently exists is once again stronger and provides that an AIA will be considered only in an area, quote, with very serious alcohol-related problems where it would take extraordinary resources to identify the particular licensed businesses whose customers contribute to the problems. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Romaine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We are in opposition to Senate Bill 764. I know that comes as a big surprise to all of you. Generally speaking, I have a rule against testifying after anybody that's carrying a weapon, and especially in opposition to them, but I'm going to kind of skip over that right now. But I do want to say that it's very interesting, if you want to look at this problem seriously, as you should, that really what we're talking about is the price to the amount of alcohol. What people gravitate to, street drinkers gravitate to, is the cheapest alcohol they can get, the cheapest bang for the buck. So if you're going to look at this seriously, you have to look at all alcohol, not just beer and wine, but you have to look at spirits. You have to look at combination of things that people can buy. The fact that you can't buy a can of something with caffeine and alcohol in it is great, except for the fact that you can buy the caffeine and alcohol separately and put them together in a drink. Doesn't seem to make a whole bunch of sense. That's number one. It has to apply to all spirits. Number two, in Washington State, which has the six AIAs, as Sassina mentioned, they do it by way of alcohol or specific products. And what's interesting is when you read the Portland application to the OLCC for their AIA, they praise Washington State. They say how wonderful it's working in Washington State. And then the way they go about doing it is to set up a system that's totally different than Washington State. They try through all types of ways to exempt as many Oregon people as they possibly can, which presents a constitutional problem. It's a little thing called the Commerce Clause. What happens is, by defining the product so that you eliminate every product produced in the state of Oregon, the purpose or an effect of that exemption is really to benefit your in-state versus your out-of-state. But in doing so, you do some really stupid things. So, for example, that alcohol that we're causing a lot of the problems, the ones that had caffeine and alcohol together, those products were produced by brewers that are under the federal tax threshold for big brewer. So those products are produced by the same kind of brewer for tax purposes as exists in the state of Oregon. So all those products would be legal if they were in the proper size package within the state of Oregon. They would be legal if the caffeine was out and they were 12 ounces or less and packaged in a four-pack. Second of all, it is almost impossible to go about changing the labels on products to fit an alcohol impact area. Nobody in their right mind ever does it. It does not occur in Washington State. We checked that with the Washington Liquor Control Board because we heard that rumor. We checked it out because we were very concerned about it, that people would actually be changing the product label or doing something like that. You have to go through federal approval for labels. Nobody does that. So it's not going to occur. What we're saying is, number one, it's questionable whether alcohol impact areas really do work. But number two, and more importantly, if you want to do it properly. Our folks are the ones who are sort of the guardians. We're the ones who, generally speaking, deliver the product to the retail shop. That's why we are in existence. We're the buffer between the retailer and the manufacturer, if you would. We can administer a product-specific AIA. We can actually do it because we know what we can and can't deliver. But when you put up these general categories of things that trying to exempt different folks, it makes it very difficult for us to do so. So if you do something like this, you have to make it so that it can work. We are not going to come up here and tell you, don't do it. We will die if you do it. We can live with it. We don't like it, but we will live with whatever you put out there. But if you do it, you have to do it the right way. Otherwise, it does become a gigantic pain. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Go ahead.
Chair Bauer, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I wasn't signed up to testify, but during some of the questioning, I thought it was important for us to make a clarification. The Oregon Wine Growers Association has not taken a position on this piece of legislation, but I can give a little perspective from the past few months when the City of Portland dealt with its AIA issue. The Wine Growers Association was not consulted during the development of their plan. We got involved after it was already in the works. And if we had been involved, I think we could have informed the conversation. To Mr. Romaine's point, that there is a good way that you could do this, and there's ones that can create unintended consequences. And just the point that was made earlier, fortified wines do exist here in Oregon. We make fortified wines, but these fortified wines can also be sherries and ports and Madeiras. And just because you have an alcohol level designated, in the case of Portland, it was 14%, that doesn't mean that those are all the kind of wines that the inebriates are drinking on the streets. These are high-priced wines that the good Oregon winemakers are producing. So you can't have a blanket, no fortified wine over 14%, or it's going to capture some wines that legitimate customers are consuming in the state. So you have to be very careful of how you do this, if indeed you're going to do it. There's some other issues that Portland didn't grapple with. One of the trends in the wine industry is soft cartons. That's a way to be more environmentally sound in the production of containers. They're smaller. They're sold quite a bit on the East Coast in nice restaurants and retailers. We're not talking about the big cartons. These are small cartons. But it is a trend to cut back on the glass production. So, again, it depends on how you structure this. And our request or our counsel would be that if any city wants to pursue that, that they include the producers in their conversations, because I think we can add a good voice of the best ways to put something together. So, thank you very much.
Any questions from the staff?
I have a question.
Senator Edwards.
Mr. Chair, question for Dan. So, I'm looking for in the bill how much is specified in the language of the bill versus how much is turned over to the rulemaking that's authorized by the bill? Because you said get it right, and I'm thinking, well, the rulemaking process is a good way to get it right.
Yeah.
Because you can really get, you know, down to those definitions that you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, that's right. And this isn't necessarily a comments toward the bill. It's more toward the folks who are in the room from the various cities who may actually do this, that we would just request that they work with the industry in producing any good AIA rules if they indeed are allowed to proceed in that way, because I think the City of Portland did not do it in a way that I think will work very well, and we were on record to say that. So it's not necessarily a point to the bill, but just to a point to the cities that may want to pursue this.
Okay.
No, it looked like Mr. Romaine might have had a comment to that same question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, the point that I think Mr. Jarman was making, and I would make also reiterate, is the bill should be more specific about what can and can't be done if you are going to do anything. That there are a lot of things you don't want to have hanging out there. Saying simply you can create an alcohol impact area, that's the easiest thing you can do. You could say any city over X can create an alcohol impact area, period. Now go forth and conquer. Or you can get more and more specific. You put down certain criteria. There's a lot of criteria that really need to be fleshed out that really give some guidance to cities and counties if they want to do anything like this that needs to be spelled out.
Sounds like, listening to Mr. Irwin, that there may not be any statutory action required at all and do it under general powers.
I refuse to answer on the grounds it might tend to incriminate me.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this? Seeing none, we do not have a fiscal on this, so we can't take any action on it. So we will close the public hearing on 764. And we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 669.
Thank you, Chair.
Richard.
Yes. Senate Bill 669 allows the advertising of alcoholic liquor at sport venues and amphitheaters with seating capacity of more than 3,000 people and dance halls that are at least 5,000 square feet in size. There's no revenue impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal. And there is a -1 amendment that the committee has received, and that has no new impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal on it.
All righty. Carla Thallon? Yeah. Well, how about Randy Tucker and I can't make up the last from Portland Arena Management. Why don't you all come up? You're all for it.
I can go for it.
Carla, if you'd like to start.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kara Thallon. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I'm here today testifying in support of Senate Bill 669 and the proposed -1 amendments. This bill is a collaboration of industry members, tourism partners, as well as the OLCC. And very rarely do we get to testify on the same side of the bill as the OLCC, and this is the second time in 2 weeks, so pretty proud of us on that. Although there has been an exemption for liquor sponsorships for venues with 10,000 seats and above, for some time, this bill will extend that exemption to include amphitheaters, sports venues within the state of Oregon, anything with over a 3,000-person capacity. This was brought to our attention in an OLCC advisory committee when it was pointed out that maybe some of the current signage in sports venues today, as well as festival sponsorships, may not be in compliance with the way the law is currently written. And this bill will allow not just for the sponsorships of the venues themselves, but also to allow those venues to recruit and book bands or rodeos that have national sponsorships of liquor. So, for instance, a lot of the rodeos are put on by Jack Daniels, or some of the comedians have sponsorships. This will allow for those venues to go after these particular entertainment and book them into the venues. And that's important in order for our venues statewide to be able to attract these national shows. It's good financially for tourism. It's good for the venues as well as for the state. There was a question at one point whether or not we would need this bill because a lot of those festivals have a nonprofit beneficiary that they pass on to. And because of that, they have an exemption there. But we did some research, and we did find that there were a few instances where that's not always the case. For instance, Deschutes Brewery sponsoring the Les Schwab Amphitheater. That is not a nonprofit, obviously, relationship there. And they would like to be able to do that as well as sponsor specific concerts at that amphitheater. Like I said, this bill has been a compromise with all the different parties involved. With the amendments, we did remove the dance hall mention, which some of the parties felt uncomfortable with, meaning that this they didn't feel that it should apply to venues that were of that size, some of the smaller venues, and we're fine with that. So this will only apply to the large venues, anyone with 3,000 and over, and we we believe that those sponsorships should be allowed. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, who wants to go next?
I'll go. For the record, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. And I know whenever there's a piece of legislation that deals with the OLCC, your first question is generally, what does Metro think? So I'm here to talk to you.
Who says that?
Isn't that your first question? Well, the reason we're interested is because, as you may know, in addition to all of the other exciting work we do, we own and operate the Oregon Convention Center, we own and operate the Oregon Zoo, and we do not own, but we operate the Portland Center for the Performing Arts, which includes the Schnitzer Concert Hall, the Winningstadt Newmark Theaters at the Antoinette Hatfield Performance Hall across the street, and also the Keller Auditorium. And so we have a number, and we have, by the way, also the Expo Center, but though I don't think this is as relevant to the Expo Center, Portland Expo Center. But we hold a number of events in these facilities where sponsorships are often beneficial. The specific thing that's been mentioned to me over the last few weeks is we have a series of outdoor concerts in the street between the Schnitzer and the Hatfield Performing Hall. It's a series of concerts called Music on Main, and I believe that is covered under our full on-premise license that we have out of both of those facilities. If not, it's a temporary license, and either way, it would be covered by the legislation here. I just wanted to say we were interested in making sure that the language didn't preclude sponsorships of these kinds of one-time or they're not ongoing liquor establishments, their events, so worked with OLCC, and they were very flexible in making sure that the language accommodated these facilities that we operate, and so we're in support of the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer and members of the committee, I am J.E. Isaac, Senior Vice President with Portland Arena Management. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 669 with the -1 amendments. The legislature has permitted manufacturers and wholesalers to purchase advertising time and space in the venues we manage, which are two venues over 10,000 seats, since 1995. In the past 16 years, we have never had any problems or complaints arising out of the purchase and sale of the advertising, and we support the inclusion of the smaller venues and the publicly owned venues set forth in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions to this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Linda Bidnoski. And what does OLCC think?
Hi.
And what does OLCC think?
For the record, I'm Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Here to provide you testimony on Senate Bill 669. Our commissioners yesterday voted to stay neutral on this one. We did work with the industry to craft some language that I think we can all work with. And so I'd like to give you a little bit of background. Some people, you may know this and some people may not, but this section of the law is part of the Tide House laws in our statutes. Tide House was born out of back when alcohol prohibition. And when the states decided to came out of prohibition, our lawmakers felt it was important to clearly define the separation between manufacturers and retailers. This was based on their experience of why prohibition happened in the first place, because of the abuse of the marketplace that happened during that time. Tide House laws are a result of that effort to define and separate the relationship so we don't end up back with that confusion and overpower of the manufacturers and the retailers. Tide House separation is still, we believe, relevant today in our marketplace. These laws protect the interests of our alcohol beverage manufacturers and retailers to ensure that the retailers are not influenced or controlled by the manufacturers and maintain a fair marketplace. The federal government is also very concerned about the separation of manufacturers and retailers, so it's at the federal and the state level. And at a fair marketplace, if you look back, if you allow manufacturers to pick and choose venues to provide money to. And then you begin to, the smaller venues or the ones that are not as popular would get squeezed out of the marketplace. So these tight house laws provide a fair marketplace for your retailers. Over time, though, we realize that our business practices in Oregon have changed, and alcohol manufacturers still operate still under these strict regulations. Right now, your ORS 471401 provides an exception that was referred to earlier that only allows those places that have 10,000 fixed seats to have the ability to purchase, to allow manufacturers to purchase advertising space. That clearly is probably two venues in Oregon. It's the Rose Garden and probably the Memorial Coliseum is the only two venues that would be able to fall within that exception. We believe it's reasonable to allow more venues to be able to do this, but we are concerned that to make sure it's still larger venues that, and it's for events. So one clarification on the law, as you first read the Dash Amendment rules, the first part, just for a clarification, now, when you first read it, it looks like the maximum is 3,000. And what we are trying to say is this exception is for those venues who have 3,000 or more capacity, not less than 3,000. So if we need to change that language a little bit to make that clearer, that this is clearly for those venues that have the capacity of 3,000 or more. There's agreement with the industry that this was not something they were interested that everybody could be participate in, that we wanted to make it clearly that it was the bigger venues. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So it's unclear to me whether you're supporting the bill with the dash ones or not.
Well, we are. I'm supposed to say neutral. We're okay with the languages. We just want to make sure that it's clear what that 3,000 threshold is. It's venues that have a capacity of 3,000 or more, not maximum 3,000.
That's changed in the dash ones.
It's changed in. Have you seen the dash ones?
It's just dash ones. Amendments was changed.
And you're okay with the dash ones?
As long as that's clear of how it reads.
Neutrally okay.
Neutrally okay.
Clear with that? Okay, I guess I'm clear with that. All right, any other questions? Okay. Okay. Mr. Romaine, you had a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. So I just dropped something. Sorry. Thank you for allowing me to come up and testify. I forgot to sign up for this bill when I, in the rush, signed up for the other bill only. The distributors support the bill. We're fine. The way it's structured, it truly allows us to purchase advertising versus, in effect, buying a retailer. And when you read the beginning of Division 13 of the Commission rules, there's sort of a blanket policy statement there which really epitomizes what your financial assistance and tight house rules and laws are all about, which is we're allowed to promote our products but not underwrite a business's expenses, not underwrite, in effect, support that retailer in their normal everyday business expenses. In larger venues, you are truly purchasing advertising. It's advertising for your product. You're getting a lot of folks in there to take a look at it. And that you're purchasing, it's the advertising value. In smaller venues, you will tend to make a decision on whether or not you can see if you can sneak a exclusive contract or something like that with them. And that is what is prohibited. So we are in support of this change. It will allow a few more venues to open up so that we can have different advertising, hopefully tasteful advertising, and be happy to answer to questions.
So are we leaving some folks out, some country fairs or something, by this language?
Mr. Chair, I did not draft it. I don't know for sure, and I'm generally not one who goes to many country fairs.
Well, Linda's coming back up.
I'll try it.
Chairman Byer, members of the committee, we also looked at this too to make sure. I've polled my managers across the state. Most of your rodeos, this is mainly the rodeos, that are like are. Either the license is a temporary event, and it's usually taken out by the local government or the county, mm-hmm. so they would fall under this one. They would be able to do that. So we looked to make sure that we didn't exclude most of the places that would probably benefit from this.
So small city, you know, summer street dances and things like that would be covered under this?
Senator Byer, if the license is taken out by the city government.
Okay. I guess that's okay. Anybody else wish to address us on this? No? Going once, twice? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 691. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 691.
699.
Excuse me, 669. I was already to the dash one. Excuse me. To be clear, on 669, and the chair will move to get us going, the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 669. Discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. The dash ones are adopted. We've just been handed the fiscal on it. It says there's no fiscal impact, there's no revenue impact, so the chair would move Senate Bill 669 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 669 is moved to the floor with a due pass with unanimous support.
I'll carry it.
Senator Girard wants to carry this. Wow.
I'm the chief sponsor.
Oh, I wish I'd known that.
I knew. That's the reason I didn't tell anybody until you voted.
Well, we need to go back to it anyway.
I know how to play my cards.
Yeah,
sometimes it's better to be quiet.
Let's see. Now we're down to... We recessed. We will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 770. And I have Mike Sullivan. Oh, let's get everybody up here. And Diane Lancaster and Mike Ellison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Chair. Hi, Senators. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. And I'm here because we are strong support of this legislation, this bill. We have lost over 800 jobs in the last 2 years. These are high-skill, high-wage jobs with a good benefit package. And the companies that they work for also support the tax base of the communities. So it's a real loss. And in fact, Blue Heron, as everyone's now aware, is shut, and it was the largest tax contributor to the community. We need to promote and keep businesses in Oregon for the things we need in Oregon and help the economy grow. Our economy, where the taxes are paid by the workers and the company, help keep a functioning government that we all seem to want. You cannot have a government without a tax base, and Oregon is losing that in the private sector. So it makes good business sense to give consideration to those who work and invest in Oregon. It makes sense. Common sense, dollars and cents. You may have seen the TV commercial where they exclaim on the idea that 25% of the food is spoiled by the time it gets to market due to transportation issues and the like. And the other thing you have is you have raw stock paper going to China 6,000 miles away. It makes me wonder why people aren't bringing up the carbon footprint that we always hear about. I believe in what long time Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill said, that all politics is local. And so we, AWPPW, thank you for bringing this bill up. And we again strongly support it, not only AWPPW, but steelworkers, local 8378 in McMinnville, Oregon, who represent the bargaining unit for Cascade Steel, which I worked for 25 years, and the president of the local for six. And there's a real good example of a jewel in a community that's worked and is a very productive plant. If it was to shut in Yamhill County, it's undoubtedly the largest private sector employer. It'd be devastating to the citizens of Yamhill County. And when Senator Beyer, or your Senator Beyer, Senator Boquist was talking about unions, he in particular saw the president of 837 H.L. Munger, and that was 872 Bill, Senate Bill 872 in 2009. They also strongly supported. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions that I might be able to.
Thank you, Mike. Does anybody ask questions, Mike? Senator Girard.
Yeah, the question. I like the bill, but I'm trying to read B. And it's written in lawyerese. Can you tell me what that actually says?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I did not write the bill, and the guy left the room that did. We're supporting it on the issue that
it does what you think it does.
It does what we think it does.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Hey, fair enough. Been there myself.
More? Any other questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. For the record, I am Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services. Senate Bill 770 will amend the Public Procurement Code and will apply local preference. The code, the language of the bill would be across the entire code, which would include all ordinary goods and services as well as construction goods and services. My testimony today is not about the policy of the bill, but some concerns and questions that we have about practical implementation. I've attached for your information a piece that we have developed on procurement preferences that currently exist in the state of Oregon, and I offer that simply for the committee's information. We were concerned when we read the bill to figure out how it works. One of our concerns is that it might have some impact on Oregon bidders because of the burden of predicting and calculating the tax impact on a contract that they might get awarded as a result of the application of the preference. And we are concerned that would result in some expense to resident bidders, might even decrease participation by some because it might be some burdensome to them. And we're a little concerned that it could, because it might be complicated, it might cause their bids to that we would struggle to evaluate bids. Beyond that, we were concerned about the urgency of implementation. As drafted, Senate Bill 770 would require immediate implementation upon passage, as we read Sections 3 and 4. And since it is a fairly complicated formula, we will have to work with the Department of Justice and all the agencies subject to our authority to make sure we get it right and so that we can help everyone get into implementation accurately and thoroughly. Again, that implementation timeline would be difficult for us to meet. There, we believe, would be time and cost impact on the process. The formula is, I think, a bit complicated. I'm not sure myself yet quite how it will work. And anything that gets, certain conditions going and certain complexities going, you can imagine purchasing officers struggling with that. The other point in that area is that, again, the bidders will have to provide information about their taxes, and the bill is written broadly to include in connection with the public contract, and the taxes that they would have to provide information on are not specified. So there's we're not clear. Is it state? Is it federal? Is it the unemployment? Is it local transit tax? That type of thing that was not clear to us. And I guess there is finally some concern in my mind, certainly, about could we be setting up resident bidders to be protesting against each other, arguing about whom, because we frequently have resident bidders and non-resident bidders at the competitive table. So would we be setting up any very unfortunate circumstances where a resident company and another resident company would be battling over whose tax information is actually the right tax information? And so, again, we're uncertain about that. We feel there would be some difficulties with the way the bill is currently drafted in being clear about how to put it into effect.
And just as a sort of a postscript, we are also aware of House Bill 3000, which is about a similar type of preference effort for Oregon resident bidders. And thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Senator Girard.
I actually like the idea of the bill, but the problem that I wanted to ask you about, and I don't think you really touched on too much, is national trade laws. Does this put us in violation in any way with interstate trade?
Sure. Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, I am not a legal expert and certainly would defer to Department of Justice in such matters. My take on it, and what limited information I have kicked back and forth with Department of Justice, is that the preference in this bill applies to goods manufactured or produced in this state. And so I think that makes a difference. And it may be that the committee will want to have some further inquiry about that, how that makes a difference. But I would not be able to say, you know, with authority, that it does not have any impact.
It seems to be, while more complicated, very similar to the reciprocal preference law that's already in effect.
Yes, Senator Beyer, the reciprocal preference law, actually, there are, and I think Senator Boquist might have referred to this in his earlier remarks, the majority of states in the union, and Oregon is one of them, we are surrounded by states who basically say, we'll do it to you if you do it to us. So Idaho, for example, Washington, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, California, basically their laws say reciprocity. Oregon, if you prefer, give bidders, say, a 5% preference outright, and you disadvantage our bidders in your state, we'll do the same to yours. This particular bill has a twist on that that kind of formula, and I frankly am not sure at this point, again, whether it would automatically kick in some reciprocity by our neighboring states. I'm just not totally clear on that. So, again, I'm sorry I do not have a definitive answer for you, but clearly these are, the devil's in the details in some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Thank you, Mike.
Yeah. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. Ms. Lancaster has actually hit on just about every one of the points that I probably would have made. I'll mention a couple of things very briefly. Our association was lucky enough to be part of one small part of a work group with many public and private stakeholders over the interim, trying to look at ways that you could apply an additional preference. And frankly, we had trouble coming up with any one idea that wouldn't create more problems probably than it would solve. So with that, we look at this bill, and as Ms. Lancaster stated, the section 1, subsection 3, figuring out the taxes, as far as we read it, one of two ways that could happen. It would either be on the contracting agency to try to estimate the taxes that the bidder would pay, or on the public agency to figure out the taxes that the resident bidder would pay, or it would be on the resident bidder themselves to figure out all of the various taxes that they would pay. Either way, that seems like quite a burden, considering that this would apply to every contract that falls under the public contracting code, goods, services, construction. So we think that it may be unworkable. And then I would also mention that House Bill 3000 may be a little bit better way to approach this, because it allows for a permissive preference if a public agency determines it applies to goods and services. If the made in Oregon goods or services are up to 10% more, it would allow a public agency to make a determination if they wanted to apply a preference. That may be more possible and may sort of be more effective when it comes to some of the reciprocity and reciprocal penalty issues that Oregon bidders would face than in other states.
I'm not sure it's workable, Mike, but I thought I heard Senator Boca say that the onus would be on the bidder to provide the information and do the analysis. I'm not sure how you do that, but...
Chair Beyer, you're correct. He did say that. When we read the bill, we weren't sure from the language of the bill, but accepting that that's true, that it would be on the bidder, that still puts a lot of work on a resident bidder that they may not be looking for.
Any questions?
Actually, I have one.
Senator Gerard?
Yeah, and then it goes back to the tax question. Maybe you need to help me now because I'm not 100% sure how this works. But say that there is a bid on the Columbia Bridge crossing up there for $100 million, but it was won by an Idaho firm. Now, who do they pay taxes to?
Senator Beyer, Senator Gerard, interesting question. I'm not a tax expert, but if they have an Oregon business registration and they are doing business substantially, you know, it'd be difficult if they're doing business substantially on the Oregon side. If it's an Oregon corporation, it would seem like they would pay Oregon taxes, but an Idaho corporation with an Oregon contract doing that work, where does that money go? And I'm afraid, sir, I don't know.
Certainly their employees, if they were doing the work in Oregon, would pay taxes, Oregon income taxes, on the wages they earned in Oregon.
Yes.
The business is a little more complex. I believe they would have to pay taxes in Oregon based on that. It'd be like we've had this discussion on film and video.
Yes.
When you're shooting a movie in state, you pay for that income you make off of that, you pay in state.
Well, but let's use the crossing for an example where Washington doesn't have an income tax. And guess where the workers are going to go? So I agree with the premise of the bill.
It doesn't matter where they go, it matters where they
where
work.
They work. Yeah.
Well, the bridge.
You want to know which side of the halfway in the middle of the river they're working on?
Yeah. Well, it gets pretty complicated pretty fast. But, you know, I think that sometimes we have to calculate the multiplier effect that we have if the money stays local, and I think that's what the unions are getting after, and I don't always find myself in agreement. Mm-hmm. But if we could somehow keep the money here, it sure would be beneficial.
More questions?
No, I'm good.
Is that it? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rekowitz. So which side of the river do they work on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Rakowitz for the record with AGC, and I'm going to pull a Paul Romaine and say I'm not qualified to answer that question, so I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, and I want to make sure to be really careful here. I want to start with AGC, Oregon Columbia chapter, meaning we have just under 1,000 members in Oregon and five Southwest Washington counties. That's a market. They work primarily in that market, and so they're a part of our chapter. So we already obviously look at it and go in Oregon preference, so what happens to our members in Washington? But beyond that, I want to start with this simple proposition. We understand the kind of pain that this kind of a bill appeals to, the kind of economic pain. In 2007, this industry represented 5% of Oregon's economy, employed 120,000 or 110,000 Oregonians. Today, we employ about 66,000. That's as bad our industry has been hit as bad as anybody in the state. So we understand the appeal and the desire. Because of the bill's complexity, because I'm not sure how it would work as previous people who have testified. I'm not here to take a formal position today, but I will say that generally speaking, we don't support them in preferences, and there's just a number of practical reasons why. One is that we have Southern Oregon members. I go down to Cay Falls on a regular basis. They're trying to do work in California. We have members on the Idaho border. They're trying to do work in Idaho. So as soon as you start to set this up, you just strengthen the conditions, the preferences that they will face when they try to leave the state and actually work. And then they do come back and bring that and that, you know, take care of their families and spend their dollars here. So we've got people in, this week I've heard bidding on jobs in Wyoming, bidding on jobs in Montana, in Arizona, in Nevada. They're trying to stay alive. In the kind of economic extreme circumstances we're in today, we just generally, we can't afford that kind of 5% against us when we're trying to bid in other states, which is effectively what happens. So that's one reason. The other reason I will talk about is the bid protest and the delays that it leads to. And one person who testified talked about this group that worked in the interim. It was a very broad-based, public and private, and we all tried to work at it. There was a Buy American bill, not a Buy Oregon, but Buy America type bill, and we couldn't figure out a way to make it work without some really complicating things like bid protests, like that lead to delays. The example I will give there is that bill was based upon the federal, the ERISA, the Stimulation Act, Federal Stimulation Act, and ERISA, and it had a Buy American provision. The EPA found it so difficult to implement, they simply exempted themselves out of that process. They could not figure out how it was you could do that and still build their projects. One person did speak about the burden would be on the contractors to figure out how to supply the information that this bill calls for to determine whether you put a preference in place or you don't, or you account for it. What that leads to in these times when contractors are competing to try to stay alive is it does lead to bid protest. If I'm number two bidder, number three bidder, guess what? I'm going to look, and you know, I don't think he submitted all the right information. So I'm going to protest that bid. Guess what? Then that job is not going to start until all that protest plays itself out. So when you look at those kinds of issues, we look at them and go, please don't make it any tougher for an industry that's already, you know, really on the bottom, 35% unemployment, roughly speaking. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions other than tax questions when you're working on the bridge.
No, that's idea. A cop-out. Senators, any questions? Senator Gerard.
I do have a question. In this, is there preferential treatment for American versus, say, Canadian?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is we could legally do, and
at the federal act, are we?
Well, I'm say go back to the bridge, and we leave the tax question out of it. I mean, we're talking a few billion bucks here, so say that a Canadian firm was to bid on it, or a Japanese firm, or someone like that. I mean, I would assume the AGC would take a position on making sure those jobs stayed American. Can we do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, I don't know how that plays into the larger issues that have been raised here. This could have to do with trade treaties, international treaties between our government and theirs. My sense of the CRC project is if that was the concern, you could deal with that, associated with that, as that matter comes before the legislature, which it will. We're beginning some work, and there'll be some work here in the next few weeks. We're part of that coalition. We certainly believe that needs to be built. So if that was the concern on a project of that size, then I think you could have the time to figure out how does that work. Can you do this? Do you run up against this law? That sort of thing. When you're putting this kind of law in place, one of the person who from DAS who testified, it is very broad. It is every single public contract for every single public contracting agency across the state of Oregon. That's how this law applies. So that's very broad-reaching, and it's all for 279A, which is procurement, all goods and services, and C, construction. You know, dealing with one project of that size and significance, you have time to deal with that one. This just changes the whole law of the land in a pretty dramatic way. So that's the best I can do.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's all I have to testify on this. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 770. We do not have a fiscal or a revenue on this, so we can't take any action on it. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 782. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 782 requires counties to notify the Department of Employment with the name, date of birth, and Social Security number of defendants upon incarceration. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
And Susan Johnson.
May I?
Oh, sure. Senator. I thought you left the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, that might change my vote.
Mm-hmm. My name is Chris Edwards, State Senator in North Eugene, West Eugene, Junction City. I bring you Senate Bill 782. This bill is in response to some media reports this past year about ordinary Oregonians who would be due unemployment benefits, yet because they shared the name of somebody being detained by a county jail, they were denied unemployment benefits, because if you're in jail, you're not available to work. Therefore, you're not eligible for unemployment benefits. So currently, county jails report to the employment department the name of the individuals being detained in the jail, but they do not provide any additional information such as a social security number or date of birth. So if your name is John Doe and you're an ordinary citizen and you have unemployment benefits due you, but a John Doe is also being detained in a county jail, there's a possibility that you're not going to get your unemployment benefits because of a mix-up. So the bill addresses the solution by simply saying...
Did you have a constituent who actually ran into this problem? Is that where the bill came from?
No. It was from media reports.
Media reports?
Media reports about it. I checked on that earlier. So, at least to my knowledge. So this bill, you know, requires the reporting of information that is already being collected by the county jails. I'm told it's very simple to do. Yeah, I think you'll have testimony from the employment department, and as far as I know, the counties are fine with it. I suppose that's why we have public hearings, and we'll find out if they're not.
We'll find out. There doesn't seem to be anybody here from the counties. Any questions of the senator?
No, I'm good.
It's your chance.
I know. It's tough. It's tough sled here.
Keeping it. You got off easy, senator.
He actually voted for my bill, so I'll have to follow suit. And
just protecting your constituents, Senator.
Thank you.
You may return.
That's a low blow. Now, I'm not sure.
Does the department have any comments on this?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee member. Kind of a short group here today. For the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I am in the acting administrator for the Employment Department's Unemployment Insurance Division. And we have read this bill, and we support this bill.
Okay.
This will save us time. It will save us from making some mistakes. We've made a couple of mistakes over the past year, and as Senator Edwards indicated, it was rather embarrassing. We suspended benefits for individuals who shared the same name as other individuals who happened to be incarcerated. And those folks went to the media. We do currently, four counties do provide us with the name, date of birth, and Social Security number. Very, very helpful. So we support this.
Questions?
I'm good to go.
No, guess not.
Okay.
I don't know about Cinder.
You know, Her staff is looking for her.
All righty. So we will recess momentarily. Oh, wait a minute.
Question, I gotta do the last one.
Hold on.
Wait, what do you need here for both of them?
Hold on.
Could you open the curtain on this one? Because I need to read this into the
record. Oh, and that's the one up above. I was going to do that. So we'll recess momentarily on 782 while we try to find Senator Burdick. And we will reopen on Senate Bill 764. Richard, do you want to put that in the record?
Sure. We got written testimony from the City of Medford Police Chief in support of 764. He wasn't able to drive up today.
Cops like restricted rural areas. Okay.
Yeah.
So we will close once again on Senate Bill 764. Is there anybody here on Senate Bill 54? Good. So we won't open on that. The
fine birdie.
No, the department decided to pull it off. We're going to. Wait a minute. Oh, there she is.
Sorry about that, Mr.
We will reopen a work session on Senate Bill 782. Senator Edwards moves Senate Bill 782 to the floor with the DUPAS recommendations or questions. Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 782 is passed to the floor with the DUPAS recommendation. Senator Edwards is the carrier. Is there anything else to come before the commission? Excuse me,
54?
The committee today.
You're doing 54?
We are not doing 54. The department asks that it be dropped.
Okay.
So we are. I don't have to do anything on that.
On 54? No.
We're adjourned.